are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomas on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our fall membership drive. Help us meet our $55,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's organic, free-range, independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting the word KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Our members continue to fertilize community radio every time they give.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Hello, For the Wild community. I hope you are enjoying this transition to fall if you're up in the Northern Hemisphere. I am watching the weather shift before my very eyes and looking forward to a slower season. But before we start this episode, I wanted to quickly send a huge thank you to all of our listeners who support us on Patreon. Your support means the world to us and truly allows us to keep making free, well-researched, and intentional content at a sustainable pace. This month, we are launching a new set of tiers on Patreon aimed at creating a library of deeply rooted resources for those who sign up. At $2 a month, the Stacks tier offers supporters transcripts, music playlists, access to gift guides with product discounts, and extended episodes. At $5 a month, the Study tier offers everything from the Stacks tier plus giveaways, a monthly field guide zine, and access to seasonal online gatherings. At $25 a month, the Archive tier offers everything from the previous tiers plus priority for Q&A in gatherings and producer credits in the field guide scene. At $100 a month, the Living Libraries tier offers everything from previous tiers plus a contribution on your behalf of $25 a month to our current land protection project and seasonal letters from the land. Listener support is one of our main funding sources, so if you enjoy the podcast and want to see it keep running, please consider signing up for monthly support. With this, I'd love to give a huge thank you to our team, Erica, Julia, Evan, Jackson, and Jose, whose dedicated work across audio, editing, design, research, and writing makes For the Wild possible. Your donations support our small but mighty team of creatives who are deeply dedicated to this project and all of the work that goes on behind the scenes to bring you podcast episodes, zines, slow studies, and more. If you feel called to support us or deepen your current donation, please visit patreon.com/forthewild to sign up. If you would rather make a one-time donation or a recurring donation outside of Patreon, please visit forthewild.world/donate. If you can't support monetarily, please consider leaving us a review wherever you listen to your podcast. Any support means so much to us. With that, let's get on with the show. Thank you from the whole For the Wild team. Hello, and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today we are speaking with Stephen Jenkinson.
We tend to change the things we can afford to change. We tend to voluntarily live without the things that we could kind of live without anyway. It's a rare circumstance when people cease their search for the corporate and systemic bad guys long enough to consider all the micro decisions that go into a normal day of sustaining the status quo. I mean, sure, there's bad guys, you know, but we are more than capable of duping ourselves and each other.
Stephen Jenkinson, MTS, MSW, is an author, culture activist, ceremonialist, and farmer. He teaches internationally and is the creator and principal instructor of the Orphan Wisdom School, founded in 2010, with master's degrees from Harvard University, Theology, and the University of Toronto, Social Work. He has worked extensively with dying people and their families, is a former program director in a major Canadian hospital, and former assistant professor in a prominent Canadian medical school. He is the author of several books, including Reckoning, A Generation's Worth, Come of Age, Money and the Soul's Desire, and the award-winning Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. Well, Stephen, I'm so excited to be back with you after a few years. It's really been altering to have connected with you a few times in the past decade, and I'm looking forward to these wanderings we'll go through together today.
Let's see if I got the stuff.
Okay. Well, gosh, yeah, there's so much stuff to wade through. And I recently became aware of a book that you have come out with called Reckoning with Kimberly Ann Johnson, who we had on the podcast recently. And I think it would be a great place to begin thinking through the process of what reckoning in times like these might mean and how we can engage with the dance of reckoning. Of course, not trying to figure it out or looking for solutions, but just being with the reckoning of this time.
Surely. I think we, by the process of elimination, we figured that that's what we were doing. I said reconnoitering, that sounded too neutral. And then reconciling, well, that was premature. So we ended up with reckoning, which no matter what the Bible, I was going to say the dictionary and somehow that came out instead. Well, either one. When reckoning shows up, it tends to have the sound of real mastery about it. But I don't think that's what it is. I think the reckoning that we did, at least, is a willingness to see things. Now, that sounds pretty mundane. But if you consider how many varieties of aversion there are available and highly sought after, too, then you might credit the real possibility that the willingness to see things as they are turns out to be a kind of fit of lucidity. In a strange time, I'm just reminded now that apparently right at the turn of the last century, there was an official sort of hermit laureate of New York City. Not poet laureate, but hermit laureate. A kind of enfranchised and highly regarded person who'd utterly withdrawn. I'm sure she's not the only one. Her version of what a hermetic life can give you came to this. What's crucial now is that we see things for what they are. That's what all those years of silence and refuge had brought her to. And it's not a kind of solution clarity. It's a kind of absolution clarity, I guess you could call it. So I think we favored ourselves in that way and took it upon ourselves to be as faithful as we could about the carnage. And this was just on the back end of, if there is a back end to COVID-19, I'm not sure there is, but anyway, the more spectacular parts of the process had abated by the time we hooked up, and we didn't know each other at all. In fact, I hadn't heard her name before speaking with her the first time, and I didn't have my glasses on. And so I missed the visuals, and the visuals would have indicated to me clearly that she was basically weeping the whole encounter, which I think lasted about 90 minutes. And she wasn't sobbing, obviously. I think I would have picked that up. But she was, after her fashion, in a mournful state. And when she wrote later on that day to thank me for the time that we'd had together, she happened to mention this in passing, that she was basically a wreck. And my recommendation was, let's get back on the horse then before the obligation to be okay, you know, for the sake of family and work and all the rest of it sort of kicks in and moves into the spare room. That's what we did. And that was the genesis of the book, a kind of unexpected carnage.
Mm. Yeah, I'm thinking about unexpected carnage, those words together. And
In a lot of ways, I think I expect carnage at this point. And getting back to that word reckoning, just sitting with those words and what they're bringing up for me. And I guess I'm considering both individually and collectively, where do you see the most carnage, or what do you see as the spaces that need to be reckoned with the most?
Well, it's a rough act to establish a kind of pecking order for mayhem. Really, you don't want to have to be in a position to do it. But we have a lot of, as you say, a lot of contenders for the top five, the top 10, whatever it is. So in no particular order, but as they occur to me in a scale of urgency, I think the recognition that it's profoundly too late for a lot of the notions that people still insist on floating solution-wise. The notion that a market economy, a consumer culture, will of its own accord choose to curtail its buying activities. I mean, I think if I were to choose one, it would be the sad unlikelihood that a culture addicted to personal choice and sovereignty and all the rest can't find a way to nominate itself for austerity and for ratcheting down the volume, at least not voluntarily. I think that's probably the big one. You know, because we know at the level of science, I would guess, at the level of technology and all the innovations and so on, that there is a kind of collective alertness to what needs doing. It's certainly what's come to pass. But we're undone by another reality that we are the heirs of and the authors of. And that's the notion that nobody should be told what to do. That we have, you know, able-bodied citizenry fully capable of exercising the responsibilities of democracy. I mean, it's palpably, demonstrably not the case, unless you consider self-destruction to be an exercise in democracy. So it's with great lament I acknowledge that the limitations that we fail to take upon ourselves now voluntarily will come to roost as mandates and not as possibilities sooner than later, I think.
So I guess I'm wondering from that response, or should we be questioning that desire for sovereignty, or are we resisting the wrong things in our culture, in our overculture? Sometimes I think that, maybe not that specifically, but I've wondered whether it's with protest or fighting back against the system, are we just weaving ourselves more into the system? Are we actually finding the portal through, or are we getting more entangled within it?
Yeah, I think the way you've asked the question indicates that you have a fairly disturbing sense of what the likely answer is, that I think you've answered it. And I would agree with you that it's more likely the second scenario. I'll take a page from my days in the death trade on this one and say, you know, it wasn't that people were dying. It's not easy. But dying in and of itself is not the unhingement that consumer culture of Anglo-North America would have us believe. It's dying in a death-phobic culture that is the road to ruin for so many dying people. It's the context, you see. It's not the event. And the context of is a death-phobic one. As a result, then, when people are dying, you'd reasonably expect that the death phobia would come to call, that it would gather itself not literally around the deathbed nearly as much as around all the decision-making, all the posturing, all the relationship, cantankerous and otherwise, with the powers that be in the healthcare systems, in the healthcare system certainly, but just as certainly in the culture more generally. And I use that to reflect upon what you said in this fashion. The notion that a freely self-determining people will, by definition, gravitate towards sanity and good solution making simply because they're free to choose it just doesn't hold. One of the ways we make sure that we're on the path that we're on. It's not an alternative. It might be too strong to call it smoke and mirrors, but certainly the notion of unabridged self-determination is a consumer reality. It's a consumer orientation to life, I think. I certainly don't think it's a responsible one in the literal sense of the term, capable of responding. It's capable of pulling out, maybe. So with great reluctance and great sorrow, I acknowledge with you that the chances are pretty good now that most of the solutions that don't disturb things fundamentally come from the things, not from an alternative. That people left to their own devices, it would appear, it would seem to work to say that people are doing their best when they get the correct information and the correct science and things of this kind. You know, an individual turn is a matter of convenience in most cases. It's not a matter of necessity. It's a matter of convenience. In other words, we tend to change the things we can afford to change. We tend to, voluntarily live without the things that we could kind of live without anyway. It's a rare circumstance when people cease their search for the bad guys, the corporate and systemic bad guys, long enough to consider all the micro decisions that go into a normal day of sustaining the status quo.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you're speaking to this in this way, because I have been in a quandary and a deep inquiry around where we are and where we've been, especially in the last 3 years, but also the last decade or so, when there's clearly been so much information being fed to us, but where is it getting us? I can't see us getting closer to connection or reciprocity. I'm not saying everywhere, of course, it's a general statement, but looking at climate change or decisions being made by our political leaders, and even decisions being made on an individual level, it feels really chaotic. And willy-nilly is the word that came to me. I don't know why, but that's kind of how I feel, like we're all running around trying, maybe not trying anymore, maybe thought we were trying, and I can't quite tell what we, and I guess the we I'm speaking to are the ones that are conscious or think we're awake to the realities of this time. And I'm not trying to, judge myself or any one of us. I have a lot of compassion for the confusion and the frustration and even choosing complicity at times. I can say that for myself. There's moments where I throw my hands up and say, where do we go from here? So yeah, a lot of being in the trouble, sticking with the trouble. And I want to bring up your book, A Generation's Worth. And you write, quote, "Over time, money became a surrogate for kinship. It replaced the old hospitality of kinfolk, the radical etiquette of trade, the mutual recognition of cultural patrimony of worth. It probably started off as a stand-in for the soul of trade and shunted the soul of the traders to the side, and by virtue of its essential emptiness, became the soulless soul of commerce." End quote. Yeah, so I'm wondering, how has modernity duped us into thinking we should feel fulfilled with inherently unfulfilling things like money or continual consumption, or even, some of the things that we've been speaking to earlier, like resistance or democracy?
I'm not persuaded that we've been duped, really. I don't mean that we got it, that there's clarity all around. Certainly, that's not so. But the notion that we are constantly and incontrovertibly on the receiving end of a kind of cabal of malfeasance somewhere, ensconced somewhere. I mean, sure, there's bad guys, but we are The capital W, we of Anglo-North America are more than capable of duping ourselves and each other. You know, if you think about the proliferation of quote information, that's a very neutral word for what it is. But if you think about how it gets where it goes, it's not because the guys with their fingers on the buttons are sending it where it goes. It's because the likes of everybody else are in on circulating the stuff, right? I mean, these things are, they don't have a lot of adjudication attached to them. The sensoria is excited by them, and round and round it goes. And, you know, one of the clinical sort of psychic and mythic dilemmas of Anglo-North America is what used to, until recently, be called, or probably still is, the fear of missing out, right? The fear of not being in on the inside track, as if, you know, being on the forced end of the fire hose of information constitutes you being on the inside and being on the receiving end of the metrics that come from your own predispositions, your own anxieties, your own habits. Because, of course, that's what they're selling to you. So you can either, you know, spend an inordinate amount of time figuring out who they are, and then I don't know what happens after that. Or you can change your habits, for crying out loud, and reconsider whether or not you passing things along because you find them titillating or compelling or must see for everybody else achieves what you imagine it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering, alongside the value of community and kinship, you also identify the value in strangerhood, and I'd love to talk a bit more about that.
Well, strangerhood is a number of things at the same time. First one is there is such a thing. Second thing is it's not a problem. And so the third thing would be the stranger in your midst is not to be corrected and turned into another one of you. The stranger in your midst is the opportunity, literally, for the best of your culture, which I would call etiquette. That's what I'm thinking of now. The best of your culture comes forward on the occasion of the encounter with the stranger, wherein you're not trying to diminish the strangerhood of the person in your midst. You've engaged the stranger as the opportunity for you to get your own situation clarified and the best of you manifest. In other words, you're not speaking the shorthand of kinship and familiarity with the stranger for obvious reasons. You're speaking the longhand of a kind of profound and well-considered cultural patrimony that takes the form of how you are with people unfamiliar with you and you with them. If you picture that in the context of table fellowships, you can certainly see what I'm pleading for here. And people do it, of course, in the context of their home lives. You know, I just came back from Israel, just in time for the place to blow up, you know, one more time. And I was on the receiving end of a certain degree, not much, hate mail. And as hate mail goes, it probably wasn't the most hateful thing ever. But still in all, people who clearly anointed themselves of having a greater understanding of these, the complexities of these matters than I have, strongly suggested I had no business going anywhere where they were interested in boycotting. The notion, of course, that being that they had a greater understanding of Israel by not going than anybody could ever achieve by going. I'm not pretending I don't understand the appeal of a boycott. I mean, I'm old enough to remember South Africa and then some. What I'm saying here, though, is we don't all have to do the same thing. And as it happened, I was a stranger in their midst for about 2 weeks. And I worked with large groups of people almost every day for those 2 week period. And I can tell you that there was a lot of consequence, dynamically speaking, to me being there. I'm not crediting myself with any particularly helpful consequence. What I mean is simply because I was there, and I wasn't one of them, and they were concerned to make themselves understood without defending themselves, because all these matters are extremely complicated, of course, and they seduce you in the direction of paralysis constantly. And that might be one of those places on earth that will never get fixed. I don't know. But I was really taken with seeing over and over again how the autopilot that they would engage in if they had to defend themselves against accusations from outside was suspended because I wasn't doing that. I was simply not seeing things their way, but very deeply committed to seeing them. And somehow they felt the difference and they responded accordingly. And there is something about their willingness to be seen in an unguarded way that was a direct consequence of the fact that I wasn't pretending I was more familiar with them and their plight than I was. And it brought something out in them, see, which I, again, I'm taking no credit for at all. I'm saying that's the dynamic that I'm describing to you now. And it just happened a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I'm in touch with these people now and they're writhing. They're absolutely writhing. And, you know, they're working on their scene from the inside. And God knows where it goes. But it's a beautiful and, in some sense, anarchic life lesson to be a stranger in the midst of people with a highly politicized, highly polemical background to them. You know, and if they're willing to be undefended, they're trying to figure it out, you see. Sometimes it's the presence of a stranger whose strangerhood is not taken to be a problem to solve that can have enormous kind of recalibrating consequence and sometimes redemptive consequence too.
Beneath the truth lies the bones of a truth more complete. Bet everything I own. It's a truth that's bitter sweet. Beneath the waves of pleasure, beneath the tangled sheets, it all comes.
I'm thinking about strangerhood in its connection to othering and belonging and being present in this extremely divisive time where people seem to look for hatred amongst each other or differences to disconnect us. It seems like inviting in the stranger is a type of way of challenging that notion, and I don't know. I wonder what it's calling on us to be comfortable with strangerhood when people are getting more and more insulated, I guess, and we're seeing where that's taking us. Nowhere good, obviously, and of course, as it gets harder to live on this planet that was once so inhabitable for us. I wonder how that plays into the future when water becomes more scarce and the skies become smokier and it gets hotter. And we need to find some way of getting along with strangers, or maybe we don't. I mean, that's the other thing. We don't necessarily need to do anything. We can keep going down the path we're going down, but it doesn't seem like a really connective way to live. And so I wonder if you connect those things, getting comfortable with strangers and the etiquette of that and how that relates to, and I don't know if it relates to belonging in general, but I think it's a type of stretching and a practice that would be really good for us.
You know, I'm not advocating personally the idea that we get comfortable with strangerhood, because I think comfort is the halfway house to turning the stranger into another person that you kind of know or presume that you sort of know or you know good enough, or there's strangerhood, the intensity of it wanes as a consequence of you being comfortable. By virtue of the stranger being in your midst, you can't say we in such a facile way that the notion of we kind of decomposes. And you have to find alternative ways of expressing yourself that don't use what I called earlier the shorthand of familiarity. So I don't think the job here is to turn down the strangerhood. I think it's the presence of the strangerhood and the kind of gravel it introduces into the automaticness of things that I'm appealing to. And if we get good at that, it doesn't mean getting comfortable with it. It means practicing it without exercising a degree of omniscience on the matter. You know, that somehow you magically understand how this goes. Because don't forget, somewhere in the middle of the strangerhood is a person or a group of people. It's not a concept. And those people may be proceeding much differently. So that if your culture is going to be otherwise as a consequence of strangers in your midst, it can't be because the strangers, quote, behaving themselves. This is an enormous challenge to a relatively, I don't know if I should use the word open society at this juncture, but a nominally democratic society there. How's that? The idea that the stranger is on their best behavior is not a prerequisite for us seeing ourselves clearly. But it's an enormous challenge to see it that way and to allow the real possibility that the strangers in your midst may bring to the fore your reactivities because they don't look as you'd presume a stranger who's glad to be among you should behave or should look.
Along with strangerhood, another word that I've seen come up in your work recently is companioning. And of course, I think I see the value in companioning and supporting each other through these times. But I'm wondering, how can we offer a companionship that does not seek to merely appease, but rather offers meaningful challenge and critical thought?
I'm thinking as a Canadian now. Yeah, we've become somewhat infamous now for the entire consequence that is the residential school system as it was government policy until the 1960s or so. And so one of the things that's ensued from this as an imagined corrective is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that fanned out across the countryside, did a lot of fact-finding, talked to a lot of people, recorded a lot of things, wrote a big friggin' report, I suppose, for the federal government. Where it sits at this point, I don't know. I met one of the commissioners of that arrangement who came to something that I did and in a very tearful way thanked me for what I was doing. So she at least found some consistency between their project and my little project. And for all of that, I have to say that I find the whole notion of, let's leave the word truth aside, which is contentious enough, but this word reconciliation is really comes in for very little investigation and it needs more than it gets. So I'll just do it now quickly and say, the word reconciliation here is premature in a way that's almost impossible to act upon. By which I mean this, the word itself tells you that there's a primordial condition that reconciliation is subsequent to. The primordial condition is conciliation. I mean, obviously, etymologically, you can hear it. So the primordial condition was conciliation. Something happened, some kind of rupture in the scheme, and reconciliation becomes now the order of the day. I think you can guess what I'm about to say. The conciliation never happened. It wasn't that primordial condition of Europeans washing up on these shores and laying claim to the place with kind of unseemly haste and with no apparent hesitation on the matter. That's the historical record would indicate that that's, you know, by and large, what took place up and down the Atlantic coast from Baffin Island all the way down to Brazil. So what we need is conciliation. And conciliation, I think, explicitly means the capacity and the willingness to sit down in a circumstance where it is a given that you are with your equals. If that's not there, reconciliation is ludicrously premature to talk about, because there's no skillfulness in saying that you're about to recreate something that you never created in the first place. There's no skillfulness, and there's no record that I can tell that indicates that the European side of the ledger ever really conducted itself as if it was in a place it didn't belong, as if it had to negotiate its presence from that day to this, basically. So we continue to live off the avails of a system that, internal to itself, was illegal. Internal to itself. And so we will, in this country, continue to be a kind of immature and adolescent kind of enterprise, the extent to which we're unwilling to reconsider our beginnings as not being, by any stretch of the imagination, us being all we could be.
I feel like this idea of cultural monsters that you bring up kind of fits with this topic a bit. And in your book, A Generation's Worth, you write, quote, "I've contended for years that monsters are a consequence and not a cause, and so are not fundamental, elemental, though their endurance seems to whisper otherwise. I pick them for forgotten deities, abandoned place gods, unrecognized spirits of hearth, home, heath, forgotten to whom, that's mostly forgotten too," end quote. And you also go on to say, quote, "It appears that we are in the monster trade as well, withholding any and all acknowledgement of the spirits of place that don't inform, favor, and vindicate our residence here," end quote. Yeah, I would just love if you could dissect this a bit for us and maybe give us some examples of cultural monsters.
Yeah. I don't think I would use the qualifier cultural in front of the word monsters here. But here's the way it occurred to me in explicit detail. I'm lucky enough, before the pandemic, I had a school that was ongoing for 8 or 9 years. One of the stories I examined deeply in the context of the school is the oldest document we have in the proto-English, in the early form of the English language as you and I are speaking it now. And that story is called Beowulf. And in the story, there are very clearly monsters, maybe 3 or 4, I think. And so picture this now. I have a room full of alternative types who've come to my school, and they're really willing to really consider the unconsidered in their lives personally, but much more importantly, I think, in the context of the culture that they come from. And I looked them all squarely in the eye, and I asked them, is there such a thing as monsters? And the place just froze up. And clearly they were hoping I was being metaphorical, or failing that, that I could become metaphorical in talking about it and entertaining their answers, because most of their answers went in the direction of, well, there's monstrosity as a kind of idea, whether it's kind of Frankensteinian or whether it's a macroeconomic, but it's an idea. There's not an actual physical form with a metabolism and eyeballs and malevolence, is there? Clearly, that's not what I meant, was it? But that's exactly what I meant. That's what I was asking. And people had an exceedingly hard time crediting the possibility that there's such a thing as monsters, and they don't belong necessarily in children's storybooks. So as you read there, what I've come up with as a way of understanding the presence of monstrosity is to suggest it's a consequence of abandonment, principally, not a consequence of malevolence, principally. How did the monsters get so badly humored? Is that just part of the deal? Or is there some way of understanding the possibility that monsters aren't born that way. They're a consequence of something that subsequently ensues or fails to take or something of that kind. And my suggestion was, absolutely, it's a consequence of, among other things, the regime of the various monotheisms that have washed across the world over the last, 3,500 years or thereabouts, and have reduced the local deities, the local gods of place and time, and to symbolic, metaphorical pseudo-presences. And I suppose you could run a parallel that goes something like this. Do you think if there's such a thing as your ancestry in the present tense, not in the past, in the present tense, if there is such a thing, and although they're not alive as you and I are, but they have their presence, and in that sense may have their ways, do you think there's any consequence at all to you living the fullness of your life with virtually no regard or reference to them, except when you're in some kind of peak experience moment, hallucinogenically induced or otherwise, or you're in a desperate kind of strait and involuntarily you just invoke the notion of ancestor? Could there be a consequence to your generalized neglect that's not punishment, it's just consequence? The failure to maintain them in some fashion, could it not have the consequence of rendering them unable to respond to you when you call? Well, if that's true for ancestry, I submit to you it's probably true for spirits of place or gods of place as well. And there's such a thing as a starving god, I suppose, as well as a homeless one. And modernity may be looked upon in time to come as a particular consequence of our inability to live as if they are so.
My father is an orphan, yes. He is dying soon. My father is an orphan, he is dying soon. I am reminded one day I'll be an orphan too. Yes, I will be an orphan too. My father is an orphan, he is dying soon. Oh, my father is an orphan, he is dying soon. And I am reminded one day I'll be an orphan too. One day I'll be an orphan too. Oh, one day I'll be an orphan too. Oh, one day I'll be dying.
Glad you brought up ancestry, because I have definitely been sitting in a bit of confusion around it recently. I, of course, am seeing people's draw to understanding their ancestry more, going to ancestry.com, getting their blood work, trying to understand where they come from, who they come from. And when I think about people coming back with their results and they're going, I'm 50% German, I'm 30% French, or what, you know, whatever their that graph tells them, I think to myself, well, who decided the date of when your ancestors are? I guess I feel skeptical about who's deciding the formulation of our ancestry. And then we attach on to these things. And of course, there's beauty to it and importance. And then there's real tangible realities like land claims. And so I'm not trying to judge it so severely, but I'm definitely not comfortable with how we're coming to who we are and what we're leaving out and what we're grasping onto. And so I'm not sure if you have thoughts on that.
Well, you can be pretty sure that I've likely thought about it, and you're right. And I appreciate the sort of, it's not confusion that what you've just said indicates. It's a certain number of dead ends in the current understanding what constitutes ancestry, perhaps. But in no particular order, here's the first thing. You mentioned French and German. Most of these nation states are very modern apparitions. They didn't exist as we understand them today, even a couple of hundred years ago, a number of them. And they are a consequence of standardization across a wide range of local diversities and linguistic diversities and so on. So the homogeneity that allows us to use the word German or French is executed at a cost of considerable diminishment of localities and peculiarities and the intense version of what it means to speak a dialect that comes from a place. You know, all these languages come from places. They don't come from people. They're echoes of very specific places and times. So you're right to wonder, you know, how far back Ancestry.com goes. And the answer is, all you're getting from stuff like from the DNA testing is the answer to what we've discovered about everybody else, but not you. That's what your results are telling you. And they're a consequence of how many people have contributed their core sample to the technology and the calculations, right? That's what it is. So, I mean, it's something. It's more a Rorschach than it is a photograph, perhaps. And yet, there's something about it that wasn't there in the time between when these cultures started to become disassembled as local and particular things and took on this form of city-state status or nation-state status. And now, there's something available to us that wasn't there a couple hundred years ago. And it's kind of, you could call it overviews to the exclusion of a lot of particulars. These things are particularly important or provocative, I think, for people from the so-called New World, right? For people who are Anglo-North Americans in a generic sort of way, for whom the Middle Passage, you know, the passage of immigration from Europe to here, to North America, was, among other things, a consequence of a lot of flight and a lot of misery on the one side, and a vector for a lot of misery on this side. So there are people in there, you see. That's what I'm trying to say here as well. There are people with genuine foibles, a genuine kind of good intention to some degree or other, an awful lot of fear, and a misapprehension about what it means to no longer be where you once were, and the sense of automaticness that turns belonging into a place belonging to you. I mean, people did that, and those people have to show up in the DNA testing as well. And their deep misapprehension of the consequence of them appearing here has to show up in the DNA testing as well. And until it does, you know, we have little bits of information that somehow lend a three-dimensionality to our, quote, not that distant origins. But I wonder what it evokes in terms of our sense of participation in the inconvenient part of the story, as well as the honorable and even heroic part of the story that is unearthed by the testing.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for sifting through that one with me a bit. I did want to touch on the pandemic, plague, COVID-19 world we've been swimming through a bit and looking at our reaction to the pandemic, I am wondering, how did our desensitization towards death contribute to worsening realities during this time of grief and dread?
That's a very good distinction you made between becoming numb to death on the one side and grief and dread on the other side. I think the greater dread by far for people who are self-determination junkies was the frustration of the ability to choose out your manner of defying the odds. I think the great dread that you pointed out, it's a beautiful word, by the way, has to do with the challenge to your self-determination that was real. And I think I'm going to say necessary. And this is where my great lament comes to roost in the apropos of the COVID-19 days, is that we had a genuine opportunity to absolutely reconsider our addiction to mastery and self-determination. And I think we doubled down on it instead, generally speaking, across the dominant culture of North America. That's what's ensued from it. There's other things underneath that for sure, and they haven't gone anywhere. But the great sorrow to me is the missed opportunity to wonder about our habits of mastery and self-determination, and to wonder whether they're really what we imagine them to be, and do they really have the consequences that we attribute to them when we exercise them to the full. So I'm perhaps a minority in the minority of people for whom COVID-19 was a close call. But perhaps, sadly, we're going to need an even closer one to have us wonder about these fundaments that we hold dear. And I just wonder, how much closer does it have to get? How many times can we be on the receiving end of the lesson without a tremendous amount of collateral damage? Because that's where we are on the back end of this last three and a half years. A very close call, a very clear opportunity to learn, and very little in the way of collateral damage to pay for the learning. At some point, it's got to be clear to everyone who's willing to think about it that we are going to pay dearly for the lessons that we are going to have to learn in the near future that we could have got for a penny now.
Well, Stephen, this has been such a beautiful conversation, and I wish we had hours upon hours, but as we come to a close, there is one last thought I was sitting with, which is making meaning. And even without the support structures of deeply embedded or connected communities, I still think finding and making meaning is vital to the human soul. And I'm wondering, how can we start finding meaning right where we are, right in the present, in all of our trouble and confusion and disconnection?
It's a great question to end with. Well, here's the first thing. I don't think meaning is that scarce. I think we should make a distinction here in the question between the meaning we want to be there, the meaning we want to sign off on, the meaning we want to associate ourselves with, and the rest of the muck and the mire that we imagine is, quote, meaningless. But I don't think it's meaningless. We disagree with the meaning, which is a completely different orientation. So, no, meaning is not as scarce as we would make it out to be, I think. We don't make meaning for our own lives, I would say. This is what wakes are for, among other things. As long as you're around, and a lot of people my age are now insisting on being around for their own wake, they're hurrying up the process so that they have the wake before they die, which is, it's ludicrous, so ludicrous, in fact, it almost beggars speech, but it's just another form of entitlement of getting what you want while you still can. But a wake requires your absence. Clearly, that's what it requires. A wake needs you dead in order to happen at all. So you're gone from the fray, right? Your voice is no more. And it's now and only now that the meaning of your life begins to be assembled and considered and disassembled and reassembled yet again. And this is where your life is taking on its ballast, its valence, as the consequences of how it was lived by you are rolled out by the people who are your witnesses, faithful witnesses or otherwise, you know, tangible witnesses or otherwise. So this is who we are to each other, it seems to me. Ultimately, we're the architects of the meaning of other people's lives. And if we really understood the power and the consequence of that responsibility, we might not be so fast and loose with what we say. I'm not saying we would pass everything through the filter of everything that's agreeable. No, but authenticity minus your attitude about the person is kind of the order of the day. And the other side of gossip, I guess, is what I'm talking about. And that's real village-mindedness at work, I think, is the willingness to attribute to a recently dead person a layer of consequence among you that they couldn't have entirely performed when they were alive, because it was still it was a project, wasn't it? The meaning of your life was a project. And now that you have nothing more to say about it, it's the chance for the rest of us to weigh in and assign that to you. Understanding, of course, that the day is coming where your life will be similarly spoken of and spoken into existence. And that understanding could very likely have the consequence of moderating and evening out your instinct for recrimination or otherwise. And something about the authenticity of the times could actually survive your feelings about the dead person, such that even your feelings become a small part of the story instead of the authorized version of the story. You know, that's what I'd hope for anybody listening, is that they could live in such a way that such a time would come to everybody around them that they claim to love and hold dear and hold in some kind of regard. And then you see this as a serial reality, as an oncoming reality for you personally, and it governs your willingness to pass judgment. You know, and it doesn't mean close your eyes to things you found troubling, but it does mean that you include the capacity for a kind of merciful assessment that doesn't leave anything out, but is not trying to retroactively cleanse something that shouldn't be cleansed. It should be understood instead.
Oh, Stephen, thank you. I really appreciate this time that we shared together and love the challenge. It's really good for me. So I'm sure others are feeling that too.
Well, you're very kind. And I thank you very much for the invitation, and say, I deeply welcome the exercise myself, and I welcome the challenge too. And you know, we're not trying to be right. We're trying to see if we can see. Just trying to see things clearly.
Thanks for listening to For the Wild. All of the songs in today's episode are original pieces by Stephen and his band with Gregory Hopkins, Knights of Grief and Mystery. Their band is currently on tour. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Julia Jackson, Jackson Krupf, Jose Alejandro Rivera, and Evan Tenenbaum.
KBOO Portland.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually, they'll go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio / interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
They'll go insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.